Order the regular meeting of the Governance Committee for the Monterey Peninsula Water Supply Project. And if the minutes can show that the county is not here, it's my understanding that the county will be here for the 28th.
Yes.
And I understand on the RFP that we won't be making any final decisions today, and we'll wait until we have a full complement of the Governance Committee. And if you'll please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Turn to public comments. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to address the Governance Committee on any item not on today's agenda. Seeing none, we will close the public comment and move on to agenda item one, which is the draft minutes for April 22nd and May 17th. And I was not here for the 17th, so we may just want to continue that item. I don't have a...
The 17th are not presented.
Right.
Okay, so we're just taking up April 22nd.
Move approval.
And any comments in public? With motion for approval. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Passes, and we'll move on to the main item today, which is the review and comment on the draft RFP for the desalination facility, and I'll turn it to you, Rob.
Okay. Maybe I'll start by just saying a few things at the high level, and then I'm going to ask Anthony to speak. Of course, this is a very voluminous document, and what you have is a draft RFP as well as the draft contract. My sense, having gone through and read them, is these are both, I guess, the way it's put together, and a lot of the language is fairly standard. I've seen it before in a lot of other design build agreements, and so one of the things that at my level I'm looking for is to make sure that the risk kind of transfer is appropriate for the industry. We want to make sure that we encourage the bidders to want to participate. Of course, on the other hand, we don't want our customers to take all of the risk. So there's a balance there that has to be achieved, and so we've carefully thought through that, and I think at least from my perspective, this is what I would say pretty standard industry fare. It is a very complex document, which is also pretty standard when it comes to this industry. There are a lot of risks, financial issues, environmental, just the legal contracting is pretty risky. So there's a lot of language that is in the document on that. I think, you know, the documents speak for themselves. We are interested in your feedback. I think in particular, there's a couple areas that I want to highlight that we would really want to get feedback on. One is that when it comes to the evaluation criteria around how do we weigh, if you remember, we're going to be selecting this contractor before we know whether we will be doing the smaller plant or the larger plant. And so how we evaluate the best contractor, we've just thrown it out there that we would equally weight the scores of the smaller plant and the larger plant. But that's something we want to get feedback on. There's also some calculations in terms of, I guess, so holistically, we don't just want the lowest price to build the project. We want the lowest price to build, operate, and maintain this project. And we're looking at the 20-year life. So we're asking the bidders to not only give us the price to build it, to engineer it, and permit it, but also to project what the power costs, for example, will be, what the operating costs will be, and to give us a sense of the replacement schedule for the major equipment for a 20-year life cycle. So that when we receive the bids, we should be able to evaluate basically the life cycle cost of the project. And to do that both for the small project and the large project. So that's something I think would be interesting your input on. Another area that...
So I'm sorry, on that, it's both the question of do you weigh each size project equally or is there a different weighting that would be appropriate?
Yes. Yeah.
And secondarily, the question about how the life cycle calculation is
right.
done, whether 20 years is the appropriate
yeah.
period. So, okay.
So you'll see in here there's a, I think it's a 20-year NPV calculation with a 5% interest rate and a 3% CPI inflation. And so that's pretty standard, I think, in the industry, but we certainly welcome feedback on that. One of the other things we've done that might be a little abnormal for the industry, but given that this is a desal plant, we feel it's appropriate to try to take this issue on, is that there are very expensive and critical components of the desal plant. One might single out the membranes as an example, where we are going to look to try to get a longer warranty period than what you would normally get when you buy something. Normally in the industry, you get a one-year warranty on everything. So in this case, what we haven't decided how long we think the warranty needs to be on some of this stuff. That if we wanted to get an extended warranty, we've said we want to have discussions with the shortlisted vendors. There's a process in here where we've set up two meetings with the shortlisted vendors, one to discuss technical issues and the other to discuss contracting issues, which is more the contract. And we've signaled that in this RFP that we would be looking to meet with them individually to essentially try to get their position on the right amount of risk transfer for some of the critical components of the project. And so we know from prior work we've done and from some of the preliminary discussions we had with the vendors that this can be a touchy area. Some vendors won't want to take that long-term risk. If too much long-term risk is put on them, they might want to increase the cost more than it would make sense. So we want to try to find that sweet spot, and we think the best way to find that is through discussions with the vendors. So that's spelled out in here. And I think from the high-level perspective, those are kind of the two big issues. And Anthony, I don't know if you want to say anything else or...
The only other, I guess, maybe high-level issue to consider is in the evaluation criteria, the way we allocated the points to 40% technical, 60% relating to price and contractual and business terms. And the reason we did that is because we've already, this is a two-step procurement process, so we'll have already gone through the first phase through the RFQ, SOQ process, whereby the you know, four or five or whatever the final number of shortlisted firms is, any one of them, in our opinion, will be able to deliver the project. So
right.
At the second stage, we're doing a little less emphasis on the technical, a little more on the price. So again, it's open to the committee's comments and thoughts, but that's the way we've structured it thus far.
So Today we are able to talk in a lot more detail if you want, or I don't know how...
Let me just note a few things in terms of the process. We, the Water Authority, we have our TAC meeting later on today and then the Water Authority Board meeting this evening. And this is on the agenda of both, such that I, as representing the Water Authority, will come to next Tuesday's meeting with direction from the Water Authority Board. So we intended to have it a two-part process, this being the first meeting that we hear from CalAM. We maybe go through some high-level questions, and then we work between now and the and Tuesday, the 28th, to provide more specific direction, and then we will have that written up after the 28th or on the 28th and submitted to, I guess it's to Bruce Finland, but to Kelman. The Water Authority has hired an outside expert, Alex Wessner, with SPI, the same person and firm we used for the apples-to-apples comparison of the three desal facilities, and he has gone through and done an initial review, and I have his at least initial notes, so I may, I'll go through that in a bit later on. But he'll continue to do his review, and on the 28th we'll probably have a more detailed review from him, and provided it's consistent with the overall direction of the Water Authority. For, as outlined tonight, I'll bring that to the meeting on the 28th. I don't know whether the county or the water...
I don't think water management has any issues with it at this time, but we're not scheduled to meet until next month.
Okay. Yeah. Right. It's my understanding that that Dave Potter will be here on the 28th. And I did encourage Dave Chardevoine and Bill Reichsmith to talk and to make sure that Dave Potter has the benefit of the technical expertise that the county has on RFPs and procurements generally. So,
especially with Chardevoine not being a county employee, but actually water resources, it actually gives a little independence.
So. Right. I do apologize. I've lumped those two together in the past, and
yeah, so,
I will
so
do a better job of not
the courts do that too, and we object to that also.
Okay. but any opening questions? I think in terms of this, I'm not going to have a highly structured thing, but it's a small enough group. Let's just any questions for Callum at this point. Do you want me to start going through my list, Dave?
Probably go through your list. I just want to clarify on the, and I remember with the women and minority disabled veterans, the percentage, 21.5%, came from the PC's
yes.
desired level. And was that the RFQ as well?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was. Was there a local share defined, or is it just a local utilization plan without a share?
I don't believe there was a percentage just in the RFQ or this document on the
okay.
local, just a general comment or request.
Okay. And is there a criteria that if somebody comes in with a higher local share that's better, or it's just a criteria?
It's just one of the criteria that would be evaluated and weighted.
There a question for Callum? I'm happy to start going through my list, or it's not really my list. Take credit for Alex's thinking.
The one other thing, maybe, Jason, just again, high level, is that there are what I would call security mechanisms in the proposed contract and RFP, things like a bid bond, performance bond, letter of credit, insurance requirements.
Parental
guarantee. These are all instruments that are very common in agreements like this to ensure that the contractor puts their money where their mouth is, and that if we engage them, they'll actually deliver. I think we've looked at it to try to make sure that it strikes the right balance between ensuring we have the right amount of security for performance, but not so much that we're driving up the cost. And so that's another area that often you could debate what the right particular percentage is of various things. I think in this case, given the CDO severity of the problem, we have maybe leaned a little bit to be conservative in that area. We want to make sure that the bidders understand that if they submit a bid, that they need to be serious about their ability to deliver on that bid. And so there's some stuff in there about that as well.
So would you, would it be fair to characterize it as relative to a standard project, you are asking for somewhat more security because of the CDO?
I don't know if you could say it that strongly. I think I'd just say that we considered it, and I think there certainly have, I've seen way worse, but I've also, you know, seen in some instances that'd be very problematic for the bidders. And so I don't know, Anthony, if you want
to. Yeah, Rob, I'll just add to that. Again, I think the types of security we're asking for is fairly standard in the industry. What, for example, the letter of credit, we're only asking for $1 million letter of credit. I've seen other deals, we have this large of a capital project, you're in the $5 or $10 million letter of credit range, which can, you know, add to the cost, of course. And often that's during the construction period, and then it's lowered when you have an operations component, which we do not have here. This is obviously a DB, not a DBO. So I think we, you know, as Rob has said, I think striking the right balance is key, and that's why as part of the process we've built in is sitting down with each of the shortlisted firms and getting their feedback. And if they, you know, if all of the shortlisted firms come back and say, hey, you know, why don't you do this? Because if you don't, it's detrimental to your cause for X, Y, or Z reason, we'll have to consider that, and that's why we built that process in. You know, I do know, for example, we have the payment and performance bonds here, and I think that's fairly standard in municipal contracting and something that some may see as conservative. And I do know from experience that oftentimes owners elect not to even require performance and payment bonds as a mechanism to reduce costs. Again, here we didn't feel that was appropriate in light of the severity. So I think that's an example of what Rob is referring to.
But I think in the hierarchy of what these things cost, performance bonds are very cheap.
Yeah.
Letters of credit are expensive. And so I think it's good security. I mean, the other thing I look at is it this way, is that we had a good participation in the RFQ. We are going to be dropping some firms out to get to the top teams that go forward. And we want to make sure that these teams that go forward actually, you know, they're taking up a spot of somebody who didn't make the list. We want to make sure that they go forward and complete the process so we can get a really good competition here. And so spelling all this stuff out in detail is very important, and it's very important that if they submit, they're willing to deliver on what they submit.
Are we addressing early completion performance incentives?
We have nothing in there on that now. So, Bob, that's an issue that if folks are wanting to do that, we could consider that.
Perhaps when we get a final timeline, make sense to take a look at it at least at some point.
Yeah, what the way it is set up, and you techies can correct me if I'm wrong, is it's part of the way it's set up is asking the bidders for their completion schedule. So it's asking them, tell us how long you think it's going to take for permitting, tell us how long it's going to take for your construction, and also it's telling us, we're asking for how much money are you spending each month so we can evaluate that spending trend, because that, you know, ultimately will impact the net present value. And so we're kind of putting on them to say, tell us your schedule. But we haven't gone as far to say, if you finish early as compared to your schedule, here's the bonus. We do have, if you finish late as compared to your schedule, here's the penalty.
Well, depending on what those timetables are, that might be something to take a look at.
Yeah.
If you could maybe talk a little bit about how this process interfaces, or how the value engineering process will work, because as I understand it, whatever the firm bids on, there is the section about providing an alternative design, but it's not anywhere near as detailed as the design that CalAm is asking for bids on. And then when we go through the value engineering phase, if we determine coming out of that, there's a, some either cost savings or increased value to be found. Cal-Am won't be in a very good negotiating position to try to get the full value of that subtracted out.
Right.
And whereas if there was a little bit more outlined in the original bid as to the contingencies, is it possible that Cal-Am could get more of that value back to Cal-Am and ultimately the customers?
Okay, so let me try to take that, how I see that, how that works. So in the RFP, our folks have put together what might be considered a base set of parameters upon which we want to see a bid. But having said that, we're also asking the bidders to come up with alternatives that they think are better, less expensive, more efficient, whatever, and to delineate those out. And then we would evaluate those. And so we're trying to get all of the creativity possible from the bidders in their bid. Mm-hmm. And that is really completely separate from value engineering. So I think we just have to recognize that, and I'll talk about value engineering in a second. But in the bid itself, I think the concept was there will be a base bid which kind of allow us to evaluate and compare the bidders to each other. Mm-hmm. But then we're also wanting them to come up with their creative ideas, put those in the bid, and tell us how much, what the difference would be in terms of price from the, you know, the base bid. And based on that information alone, and of course the bid submissions, that's how we would select a vendor. And then the value engineering stage happens generally after they've started the design.
Right.
They've moved the process down, you know, a ways. And so, and remember, the value engineering could be, you know, we could have Dave and Bill and other people, an outside facilitating firm. We could call in desal operators from around the world. I mean, you're really trying to get the smartest people in the room to critique the designer's design. That's value engineering. So in the value engineering, there might be 20, 30 ideas that come out. And then you put it back on the designer to evaluate in a little more detail after the workshop is over those ideas. And they have to come back with, okay, this one might cost us an extra million in capital, but we'll save $100,000 a year. And so you do that analysis of each one of those, and then we would decide which of those alternatives we would want to take. And at that point, you're right, the bidder has already been selected. And some might say there's that they have more leverage, but we still maintain the decision as to whether we would accept those or not. Sometimes in value engineering, I've seen bids where they'll try to remove what that issue that you raised about who's got the incentive, and they might say, hey, we'll share the proceeds of the value engineering. So if an idea is deemed to save $1 million, you might agree that the bidder gets to keep 20% of it. That sometimes is used to try to level the playing field, but I think from my experience on the value engineering, we would require the engineer to lay out the costs on the table. And so let's say we're going to save on the square footage of the building. You know, we'd lay out that on the table, and it's not perfect, but you're going to have a lot of information to try to see whether or not the bidder is padding that, you know, savings, and you're going to negotiate that. and, but ultimately, you have the decision whether it goes forward or not. So, so there's no perfect answer, but I think this kind of thing happens quite a bit, and we have good experience in it. Whether you feel strongly enough about it that you would want to try to have some mechanism where the value engineering savings are shared, I guess we'd be open to that. We could do a little more research on what we see in, you know, kind of in the national perspective on how often that happens. But
let me give you an example, and this may not fall under value engineering, but as I understand it, the base project you're asking the firms to bid on assumes a worse source water quality than we think will likely actually come out of the wells. And I understand that that's conservative on behalf of Cal Am, that assumed the worst and yeah, hopefully it'll be better than that. But if the water coming out is of sufficiently good quality, it won't require pretreatment. In fact, I think in our SBI report, we didn't assume pretreatment in Cal Am's project, whereas we did for the two open ocean intake projects. Mm-hmm. And so is that something that it would actually make sense to ask the firms to bid on, tell you now what the deduct would be if the source water is of good enough quality to not require a pretreatment, or at least as much pretreatment?
Well, I think on that one, generally, what happens with these things is that the project team needs to make a decision on what is the source water that this plant must be able to handle. And they have to look at this possibility of, well, they have to look at what it is, what they think it is today, but they also have to look at what could it be in 20, 30 years from now. And ensure that in the worst case, it's ready to handle it. And so, and then once that determination is made, I think then the design builder needs to put together a package that can meet that. I'm not sure whether it makes sense for that to be optional, just because ultimately that decision needs to be made. And I'm just not sure. I mean, Rich is not here today, but I think generally how I see this going in most DBs is that the project team needs to determine the source water. So perhaps, I guess if SPI is looking at this, my advice would be, give us some feedback on whether you think Cal Am has the right source water characteristics. And once those characteristics are agreed upon, that would drive whether the pretreatment and what level of pretreatment would be needed. That makes sense. I'm just trying to...
So what I'm hearing is the first exercise should be to get the base bid, the base design right.
Yeah.
So if we think that you're being overly conservative in this quality of source water, assuming worse source water than is realistic, we should encourage you to relook at the base case.
Yeah, recognizing that if we get it wrong,
it's going to be an add. I guess I'm trying to figure out...
It's going to be an add, and we can have big issues with the membranes.
I'm trying to figure out whether there's sort of two ways to do it. You either are conservative and you hope to get a deduct, or you're more aggressive and you think it's, and there's a chance you're going to have an add. I was trying to figure out, is there a third way where you actually ask for a bid on both? You say, okay, bid it for the conservative, but tell us now what the deduct would be if you don't have to do pretreatment.
Yeah, I think that presumes that there'll be new information forthcoming that'll help us make that decision.
Test well.
Which the test well.
Test well may be that, but I think that the technical question is, are folks going to rely on the testable data, or is it broader than that where for just for consistency and conservancy, we want to just have a broader look at what the raw water characteristics are. And Eric, I don't know if you've been involved in these discussions.
Well, we discussed the pre-treatment at length, that we have the filters included in the bid.
Right.
We talked about the availability of water quality data today for the test, but we don't have that. Having that today, there is a chance that water quality in these wells could change over time. And so the thought is we do need some pre-treatment and to limit that could put us at risk over the long term, even if the iron and manganese levels in the feed water early on are low. We want to have that capacity so that if within 5 years or 10, and water quality could degrade, that we have the processes and the infrastructure in place needed to deal with that changing water quality.
So I'm out of my league here, but I'm already in it, so I'll keep on going. we had took from CalAM in SBI work the statement that pre-treatment is not likely to be needed. And so that factored into our calculation. And I guess what I'm reacting to is now I'm hearing that you're saying it will be. And that's fine. If your thinking's changed, it's changed, and there's probably a good reason why it's changed. I'm remembering what we were told a few months ago.
I think we, you know, Rich not being here today, I think when we come back next week, I'll make sure we're ready to talk about that in detail. I think it could be the not so much the pretreatment as the level of pretreatment that might be more important. I think the level of pretreatment, for example, in open ocean intake, has got to be much more robust than it does in the well concept. I think just one of the lessons learned about desal projects around the world is that if you don't get the pretreatment right, the plant will not work. That was the issue in Tampa. American Water has a lot of experience with that project since we fixed it. There's a trade-off here between building unit operations that you absolutely do not need. And I have seen that in water plants all over this country. There are water plants, and Eric and I worked in one in Houston that had unit operations that almost never got used because the designers planned it for a set of circumstances that rarely ever occurred. The plant that American Water operates in Phoenix has unit operations and sizing of unit operations to deal with circumstances in the CAP canal that almost never occur, but the designers, the owner of that project, thought we need to be able to handle the worst case 100-year condition. We don't want the water to ever be shut down, so we're going to design it for that. And that's kind of what's going on here, is there's a give and take between the conservative engineer that wants the plant to be able to run under all conditions. And he looks out and says, these are the worst case scenarios, and I gotta have the plant ready to accommodate that. Versus somebody that's looking at how much can we get away with to save money and still make everything work. And that's what, that's why you get 10 engineers in a room and you try to figure it all out. I think so. A little more feedback from you guys on looking at what is the right source water criteria would be good, and we'll have Eric and Rich ready to talk in more detail at the next meeting on this issue. Yeah.
The second thing that I heard Eric point out is that it may be that source water, the quality changes over time after 5-10 years, and trying to understand whether that does that make sense to build it today under that possibility, build the pretreatment today under that possibility, or just leave room on the site to build it if that, if you start seeing that trend. Again, I'm.
Yeah, no, all good questions.
I don't know how these things work, but it did. I'm raising it just because we in our costing analysis from just a few months ago didn't have at least the same level of pre-drill.
Yeah, and I also add that next week, the folks from Trussell Technologies will be here as well, and they are kind of the process experts that we have on the project, so they'll be able to talk to this pre-treatment and source water in a lot more detail.
The next question that Alex has is the approach to the alternative proposals. So I understand, he understands the reason why you want to have the same baseline so you can compare across the 4 or 5 bids. And then you want to solicit the creative ideas. But are those alternative proposals going to, the design and the costing for those alternatives going to be in enough detail that Cal-Am can actually select an alternative? So not only are you selecting the design build firm, but you're saying, yes, we want you and we want the alternative that you have laid out, or how does that contracting work out?
I think the answer is yes. Eric, John, you guys would agree. I will say, however, Jason, that this approach, I would say, has been internally debated. And some of us feel that the basic premise that you would ask for the base bid and then ask for some changes based on creativity might, in a way, stifle the creative process in itself. And so there's a trade-off here. Some folks would say, don't be so prescriptive in what you're asking them. Just give them the input and the output,
right,
and let them figure it all out. Don't tell them that you need a 6 million gallon tank here or whatever. Just let them figure that out.
Yeah.
That's one way to go. Of course, the very conservative engineer says, well, then I'm not sure if I'm going to get the right equipment, the right number of unit processes. I want to have a little more control over, you know, what type of materials of construction are used. And that's where you get to, you know, specifying a little bit more. And I think on our team, based on what I heard, there certainly isn't a total agreement on this, but I think they came out with this approach basically on a consensus. And so I think that when we get into the meetings, one of the things that my question to the team was, well, if I'm the owner and I specify this is what I want and I want changes after, there might be a tendency for the bidders to try to satisfy the owner by giving the owner what they want. And I think we need to make it clear in our meetings that we just did that to establish a level playing field and that we really want the creative designs to come out, but we want the adders or the deducts in enough detail to evaluate them. I think we can do that.
So when Alex and I were talking, we were trying to understand his assessment of the approach to the alternative proposals was that it wasn't robust enough, and he was trying to figure out, do you fix that by just jettisoning it, or do you fix it by asking it to be more robust? I'm hearing you say that you very much want it to be part of it.
Yeah.
And if we have suggestions for how it can be made more robust, we should bring those forward.
I think that would be good.
Okay.
Eric, would you agree?
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, we. One of the things about the design build process is you really do want. If you tell the bidders exactly what you want, you might as well not do a design build process.
Right.
So you want to make sure that they have the creativity to work together to try to, you know, give a better product at a lower cost. And so I think we want to keep that in there.
Just the one thing I'll throw out is the other aspect is we've laid out some of the process details, but we also have, I think, a protection for us is the product water quality standards and the plant performance standards. If they propose alternatives, one of the things they still would have to achieve are those efficiency standards for power consumption and the water quality standards. Once those are set, there's not really going to be any flexibility on that. So if they do propose a different process and it's allowed, they still have to achieve all of those performance standards. And
Bill, you came in just after we got started. Are any comments that you want to bring forward now, or do you want to hold until we've gone through more of our water authority process?
You've actually just touched on, I think, what is my greatest concern. Having almost finished the RFP, I actually kind of skimmed the evaluation part. But the way the thing is written, the contract actually is incorporated into it, and as well as the appendices to the contract. Appendix 2 is extraordinarily detailed in what your expectations are from a technical standpoint. And so, for instance, if when I was reading the part that had to do with the post-treatment, there's a chart in there that tells you how much of what chemical you're going to use in post-treatment. I mean, it's got a cool chart, but it's almost like the RFP asks a proposer, it's like you take a watch and you hand it to a proposer and say, now tell me what time it is. I would have expected something a little more, how would you call it, requiring of a proposer to be creative. And in doing so, bring your costs down. I would not have even attempted such specificity, and I think for Rob McLean, that's what you were getting at. On the one hand, you can be very general, and on the other hand, there may be a more conservative, you know, engineer that says, I want to really specify this very tightly what our expectations are. But what you expect out of post-treatment is meeting the state of California water, potable water standards, and maybe some other chemistry regarding alkalinity and chlorine residual, but beyond that, why are you specifying how much of what chemical you're expecting to see in post-treatment? To me, you took all the creativity, all the flexibility, and all the opportunities for suggestions that might save you money out of it, the way the thing is currently written. And that's probably my greatest concern. I think you're going to get a good product. You're going to get what you asked for, but you've already got 90% of your design done. All you need to do now is sit down and start sketching out some drawings. And could you get right down to the building sizes and the way, this is awfully detailed for a RFP for a design build. Maybe awfully is not a good word to say, because if that's what you intended, it sure is. If I were a proposer, you've just taken away all my creativity, or almost all of it.
I think, Bill, that's the...
I'd have been way more general in the way this thing was specified, but...
Yeah, and I think that's not what we want.
Yeah.
And so maybe what isn't coming across, based on some of this feedback, is that is not what we want, that we want the creativity to occur, but there's this base set of conditions, kind of like as an indicator out there. And so I can tell you that what you just said, I had the discussion with the team. And we have guys on the team from very, very conservative to Eric, who's more thinking like me. So it's just one of these things that we got to get the right balance, and this is good feedback, and we will go back and take another look at it and see how can we ensure that we allow that creativity to occur, but that we still feel like the thing can get a permit from the state, that it'll meet the water quality requirements that we know it'll need to meet. And so I think it's great to hear this feedback because it's exactly what you and I talked about, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're not surprised, but it is good feedback, and we'll take that back to the team and see how they plan to address it.
I guess piling on this point, I thought that one of the benefits of doing a design build is that you avoid the builder suing the designer because they're one and the same.
Yes.
Right? So there can't be that finger pointing.
Yeah.
At least not that you have to deal with and we as a community have to figure out. Is there a risk that if the RFP is too detailed, that in fact you've opened yourself up to the DB firm saying, hey, we've designed and built something around your RFP. The fact that it's not working is because you had the wrong RFP. I mean, you specified some level of detail that now is creating problems, but that's your fault, Cal-Am, as opposed to somewhere within the design build process.
I don't think we'll have that issue, but I think the contract is fairly clear about where the responsibilities lie for achieving the results. We'll take a look at that and just make sure that we're not totally crazy. I guess in my experience, I've worked on design builds that are more specific than this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was frustrating for us as, you know, the bidder to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll take a look at that and see. See how we can improve the next iteration.
Yeah.
May I be permitted more than one general comment?
Yeah.
All right. There are on most of my stuff, I have to tell you, this is quite well done and are kind of picayune-ish. So I'll call Rich and or send him an email or something on this. But the project delivery on page 5-2, it's under paragraph 5.2.2. Your schedule calls for completion and delivery, although you're into the to the final phase of checkout. And,
Bill, help me. Where are you again?
5.2.
Oh, 5.2.
Paragraph 5.2.2 on page 5-2.
Okay.
Okay. Now, one way. It occurred to me that you might want to encourage early delivery. And again, my apology if you talked about this.
Cut it to Bob's point earlier.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Used to put an incentive clause in here someplace for an early delivery.
And Bill, Bill, any recommendation on how we would pay that out?
If Ari bought futures from Bob's Winery, that would be cool. No, I was thinking about, I can give you some specific wording if you like. I just made a marginal note, early delivery incentive in there. There's lots of standard clauses. I particularly like Caltrans's clause. That they use like after earthquake damage and that kind of thing, and they need to get their facilities back online in a hurry.
Okay.
You can get that right out of Caltrans' standards back.
And I don't know, Bill.
It may help with the state board also
to
then be able to point to this, that you're doing everything in your control and you're creating a financial incentive to
get there.
Now let me just, I want to get your feedback on this, Bill, because it's an important issue. In our case, we're asking the bidders to come up with their schedule. So it's important, to me that's an important distinction because we want to make sure that they don't come up with a schedule that has too much slack in it, knowing that they can get the performance, the bonus. Now, I guess in the Caltrans concept, is Caltrans giving a date and saying if you can beat this date, you get the bonus? And I think that's, if we're going to entertain this performance clause,
then you need to
set
the date.
Do we have to set the date?
Yeah.
You think so, Bob?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then we'd have to look at, we're going to set, if we're going to set the date, and
January 1st, 2017.
You may struggle with the CRA in terms of cost caps and payout of incentives.
Yeah, that's the that is another very good point, Dave. That I think that's probably why we didn't go there, as we were worried that the ratepayer advocate might frown upon that.
Do you have more in your list from Alex?
I am going through. You'll look forward to this. He has 57 items. Most of them are typos and the like. I'm just wanting to make sure I'm not missing any substantive items in that. I'm going to try to do what Bill suggested, is pass the trivial ones to offline and not worry the group. So go ahead, David.
Yeah, I'll have one really good trivial one to out-trivialize Bill. The section header 2-12 is supposed to be all capsy.
Forgive me for not noting at the outset, these are working drafts. They will change.
In looking at the reps and warranties and some of the clauses, I just want to make sure I understand a few things. So you have first step for dispute resolution is mediation, and you don't refer to jams or trying to pick a mediator, and that's okay, that's standard practice, that you'll find a mediator when the time comes for mediation.
Since mediation is optional.
Yeah.
The parties can agree at the time as to how to go about selecting a mediator.
Okay, and then the binding arbitration process, that if you can't mediate, you go to binding arbitration.
Right.
And that's also still pretty vague. So when you get there, when you get there, you'll know it when you see it, and everyone can agree to an arbitrator at that point.
Perhaps, Dave. And that's actually one of my internal notes when I reread this yesterday to myself, to, hey, do we need to spell this out a little more?
Okay.
So we're going to take that back and discuss it.
I was actually of the opinion to just delete the binding arbitration because in another project, I've had a lot of experience lately with mediation, and I guess to me it just, if you can't settle at mediation, I don't know how you're going to settle at non-binding arbitration.
Well, it's not non-binding, it's binding arbitration.
But it's upon agreement of the parties to go, right?
No, it's required binding arbitration.
So you can't.
Are you sure?
So you can't sell.
Sure.
What section is
non-binding that? Non-binding mediation. So then either party can direct that you go to binding arbitration. So it's non-binding mediation.
Non-binding and non-mandatory mediation.
Right.
Binding arbitration, and let me get to that section.
The direction of the
is this in the, I guess we're in the contract.
It's going to be in section 11. Let me get there.
Why would you go, want to go to binding arbitration?
Don, that's exactly my point. I don't want to go to binding arbitration.
Well, you might want to. It gets you finality.
Your option then, your alternative
go
is going to
court. Instead.
Yeah, I don't like it. Yeah.
Well, traditionally, municipalities and such like go to court, and companies try to stay away from it. let me see if I can find this section.
Page 90. We're in the contract.
Yeah, and again, in fact, my internal note says under 8.13A, binding arbitration cannot be declined. It's a note to clarify. It's in my mind. And again, if we decide to change that, we change that.
So my discussion with our attorney on this was, as it says in 8.13A, it's either party may make a demand.
That cannot be declined. That's the clarifying point that we need to determine what we want to say and then say it. If you look in 8.12 on mediation, I believe it says the party may decline. Let me see if I can find that. Yeah, 8.12C, either party may request, and the non-requesting party may decline. That's in 8.12C on non-binding mediation. On 8.13, we don't have a similar statement. So okay. my interpretation, and there is no discussion here about going to court. So So the intent was binding arbitration. It's final, it's mandatory. Either party may request it to initiate it, but it is determinative and final. Again, if we want to change that, we can change that, but that's the intent right now.
So I guess your feedback on this would be good. I don't, as you were hearing me talk, I don't think we have any consensus on our side.
Yeah, I mean, you need finality. And if you're not doing mandatory binding arbitration, then your other option is to go to court.
Right.
Which, when you have two private entities, you typically don't do, at least in my experience. When you have a municipal owner and a private entity,
Why the difference, Anthony?
Binding arbitration is usually a little more expedient, tied up for years. And having represented municipalities for years in the past, you want to go to court because of the kind of home court favoritism perception, whether accurate or not. That's my experience.
Charles?
First of all, it sounds like you might need to have your attorney talk to Anthony. First thing. Second.
Well, he was out getting his shoulder fixed. And we missed that.
I think Anthony was right about the expediency of the binding arbitration.
Yeah.
As a lawyer and as a government lawyer, it's not the hometown part of it. It's going to court is, to me, being able to correct a bad arbitration decision or a bad lower court decision. You get those, obviously. You get those bad decisions, and hopefully you can correct them going up in a court and in an appellate matter. From my perspective, I think Don.
I agree, but arbitration, it comes to the word arbitrary. So you have to be very careful.
Does insurance cover outcomes of arbitration the same as it does for courts, generally? I mean, if you get an award that...
It's pretty hard to get. I guess it's whether it's something that will be covered by insurance in these kind of contract disputes.
Plus, the other thing what you're doing is you're actually delegating your authority to one person.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's final.
Well,
a little quicker, but it's final. That's it.
And you always hear, Don.
If you have an opportunity to appeal it, this goes to more than one person.
Well, and you could have a three-panel arbitration panel. It doesn't have to be one person.
You could.
And
most of the time, I find those things go on forever, too.
They could.
Well, yeah, aren't
but again, you look at, I'll take the example of the RDP project, where some may argue the Villarreal decision was perhaps not the best decision, and you have one person there making a decision as well.
Yeah, but so then you can appeal it.
Then you can appeal it.
Okay, it sounds like we're not going to resolve this.
But it sounds like one that should be flagged to come back and see what you've decided prefer.
But I'm hearing from these two guys and Bob that court would be a preferable.
Court would be preferable, no question.
Yeah, I mean, typically, in my experience, you want binding arbitration when you're pretty much setting you have the upper hand. You have the leverage when you're entering the contract. When you sign up with AT&T or Apple or any of those, you're basically going to binding arbitration because they've written the contract. They've written every word of it how they like it to be.
Yeah.
And that's where you end up in binding arbitration usually.
And this is a relatively, as detailed as it is, there's still things in here that haven't been completely settled. And you flip a switch and it goes, doesn't work or whatever, and whose fault is that?
Okay, so we'll finalize our recommendation next Tuesday on this point.
And we will do some more internal homework.
Some internal discussions.
Yeah.
So two of these, the letter of credit requirement is commercial bank rated at least A2 by Moody's or A by S&P. Moody's downgraded like all 15 major banks last summer, and there's very few banks right now that I think meet that test. Did you have that test on San Clemente, and are you getting letters of credit?
I don't recall the specifics on that one.
So maybe something to just look at to see it, because otherwise you may be chasing everybody to two banks.
Right.
and I'm not sure what the level is, but BMA is like AA2 now, and City Corp's under A2, and you know, all of them took a hit.
Legitimately.
Yeah. Okay, so and then the second issue is, can you explain to me the licensing criteria a little bit? It seems to say that all of the parties in a team need to have licensing that's sufficient and consistent with the requirements, except for the small players, and that some of them didn't need it until the commencement of the project. When the teams are being put together, I know your lead has to be a professional engineer in California who can sign the plans and what have you. But are you going to require, if there's a foreign firm, are they going to have to become licensed in California? I mean, what does that licensing section really mean? What are the requirements through the team?
I mean, I'll start, then I'll let Rich and John help out here. But generally speaking, they must meet all the requirements, licensing requirements required by applicable law, whatever they may be. So it's for them to figure out, it's for us to confirm and make sure that they're on board. There were certain requirements and best practices we felt were at certain stages of this procurement process, we wanted to make sure certain licenses were in effect and obtained. So we did say, I believe, for some of them, we allow them to have the licenses in place by the time the contract is signed.
Right.
I'll stop there and let you guys weigh in on additional details as you get down the line as the team.
Yeah, I don't have to look specific, I don't quite remember, but I know in some states it's illegal to even bid a project if you don't have the proper licensing.
Right.
And we don't get in all those rules because there's a lot of different rules. We expect them to know the rules and then we kind of enforce them. But the intent was we would rather know up front that they're licensed as opposed to working down the line and find out, oh, yeah, I don't have a license to do this in California. That would be
bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, for example, I think if you have a proposer team that's a joint venture, they may be trying to figure out, okay, which member of the joint venture is going to have the license. So they're still putting their teams together, don't forget, up until a couple weeks ago.
I guess your feedback, though, Dave, wasn't entirely clear, so maybe we need to double check and see if we can make it a little more clear.
Because it was also not clear if it was going to require everybody on the team to have licenses or because the indemnification is all coming from the primary and they're all dealing with each other, that if you could have somebody who lacks a license, obviously form work in California, you've got to be licensed to do that work.
Right.
But it's just a little confusing.
Well, let's take a look. We'll take a look at that. I mean, I think we need to look at that, just to make sure we can make it as clear as possible.
Yeah.
Right. But again, generally, all the way down the line, you have to have whatever license is appropriate for the work you're performing on the project. If as a sub, you're required to have a certain license, then you need to have it.
Right.
You can't rely on the DB entity.
Section 2.15.
Section 2.15.
Okay, so we'll take a look at that. 2.15, Anthony.
I think I got caught up in the major versus not major participants and forgetting where that line is drawn.
Yeah, I think the intent there, Dave, is we're not asking for information on every single entity that'll be on a team because that's just, we don't need to be at that level of detail. So, but going in, we want to know that the major parties on the team are licensed to do what they're proposing to do. So maybe we just need to look at the wording a little better on that.
You know, there could be cases if there's biologists that need special license, they might need individual licenses.
Yeah.
That would, you know, wouldn't be under the general contractor or the engineer.
And they're probably a minor participant, not a major participant.
Exactly.
So there's, you know, at some point, it may not even be when the contract's let it. It could be that their work doesn't even happen for a while down the line.
But like on St. Money, those biologists are actually major.
Yeah.
On the project.
Yeah. Thanks.
Other comments from anyone?
Again, we have a fairly long list that I'll discuss. And let me just give you a flavor of a couple of these, not that we need to discuss them now, but we just made a public document. I asked for it to be distributed to the Water Authority distribution list, so if you're on that, at least Catherine is, you have it, or I can send it on to you right now. But things like the, in terms of the annual operating costs, the price of electricity is set at 10 cents a kilowatt hour, and is that the right working number for now? It makes a big difference.
I think for now it was, only because it could be 8, it could be 12, it could be landfill gas, but different. We have to have something at least so they know kind of roughly where we're going to be to help evaluate their proposals. And everyone would be using the same, we'd use the same number for all the proposers. Now, we'll be able to change the model.
No, but
but it will affect.
We submitted in our last submission to the commission based on PG&E tariffs.
0.09, roughly.
Okay, yeah. So maybe it should be that number instead of 0.10, I think is the point.
Yeah.
I mean, it will make a difference. Yes, everyone will use the same number because you're going to tell them what number to use. But it will affect whether or not a piece of equipment that is more capital intensive and more energy efficient, whether that costs out. So it will help to get as close to the actual number.
We should use the PG&E tariff that we understand is out there.
And there's three tariffs, and so the 10 is actually pretty darn close to the middle. 9 is on the optimistic side.
Yeah,
it's actually
the 20 tariff. You got your three levels: transmission, primary,
yeah,
secondary.
Well,
I
know.
Just say,
I'm
make to sure you pick the right number.
Yes.
And let's use that.
Yeah, okay.
You use the transmission number.
I'm just giving a flavor for these. Not that we necessarily need to discuss them.
That's a good question.
Requiring the bid pricing to hold for a full 365 days. Will that increase initial pricing, and would it be better to lock it in for a shorter period of time within some sort of escalator? I
believe that one was driven by when we anticipate getting other approvals in the project.
Well, I think we have to look at it, John, and see if it, I mean, it's a trade-off.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it comes back to just the balancing of if there's, someone's going to have to take on inflation risk and other price risk, and you want that entirely to be borne by the DB firm, or is that shared in some way between DB and client? I guess it's the basic question.
So if you have a preference on that, we would probably entertain whatever you think is the better way to go.
I don't have a preference today. I'm
yeah.
But I'm just flagging it as something that Alex.
Yeah, I mean, if we had an approved PUC order, it would be a different number. Yeah. But that's also part of that because there's some
give or take.
Yeah.
But it's also not uncommon to ask bidders to hold their price for a certain point in stuff like this.
120 days is pretty common nowadays for complex projects. I mean, simple projects at 60. This is way more than that.
So we'll look at that again and see.
An overarching comment that related to what we were talking about earlier is just a concern that
the
the amount of technical information being requested is fairly large, and that may discourage some candidate proposers. I guess that the flip side of that is you've narrowed the field to 4 or 5, and so each of them will be fairly motivated to put in the effort because they know they're already on the short list. Is that how you're trying to manage that?
And you know, this is one of the top size desal plants in the United States of America. I mean,
right.
The guy who gets it is going to be up front.
Yeah.
I mean, we think they're going to chase it all the way to the end.
Okay.
But like everything's a balance.
I'm not seeing anything else on this list that I need to raise right now. I'll send it to you now. It's not. It's just Alex's list for us to incorporate. The Water Authority has any.
Okay.
We're meeting tonight on this. So. Anything else at this point?
Dave, anything more from the district?
No, I thought I'd look up commercial bank ratings. No, I'll confess we didn't get all the way through all the documents. So
yeah.
We kind of focused on reps and warranties and dispute resolution, things when things go bad rather than standards.
It's never happened before.
Anything else from you, Bill?
Well, I have a few. If you don't mind taking a couple of minutes for some quick ones. On the very first page, it says insert short listed firms. Are you in a position to say who those are today?
No.
Okay.
I don't know that we've reported. Do we want to give an overview of the number of SOQs we've received?
Sure. I think that's on our website.
I think it's on our website. I don't know that we've reported it to the governance committee, if you care to, but we received 9 SOQs from 9 different teams. Again, at this point, we're not identifying who those teams are or who members of those teams are, but just for the record, there were 9, and you know, we're conducting our evaluation, and it's most likely that we're going to identify the shortlisted firms first week in June.
Okay.
With, again, the schedule currently is that we will issue the RFP and draft contract to those shortlisted teams on approximately June 17th. So we've received 9 SOQs that are currently under evaluation.
What, June?
June 17th is the 17th. Date we're shooting to issue the RFP and draft contract to those shortlisted firms.
In terms of the scoring for the RFQ, that's internal to CalAM, is that right? Or after the fact, do you share that with us?
And the way that the governance committee is set up is we're not supposed to share that with you until it's all, the whole process is completed.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not asking for a deviation. I just have
to. And just to add to the, I think I reported earlier how many firms were actively talking to us, and so that number 9 is very consistent with what we were seeing all along, so no surprises there, which is good.
Yeah.
Just throw that out there.
I did hear you say earlier 4 of your, expecting the short list to be 4 or 5.
Correct. Sometimes it's easy to draw the line.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Okay.
Under project site description on page 2-8, there's, is it possible to get a map inserted in there? And something simple that shows roads and property lines. Back in appendix 2, there's some photocopies of some AP maps, and they're kind of, unless you're used to reading those kind of things, are kind of diagrammatic. I think a better map would be okay here. Not necessarily for the proposers, but for other people that are going to be reading this and might want to know what's happening and where. And the map should show both the Tesla sites as you know them today, as well as the production facility, since they're both included in here. On page 2-12, paragraph 2.9.6, it talks about the construction standards, and it talks about coordination here would be a good place to insert a statement that there's other contractors going to be working on site, particularly with regard to the pipelines that are separately identified as separate contracts, and a requirement that the DV contractor coordinate with all of those, I think would be appropriate. Where that really comes into play is if you have a union and a non-union contractor and their employees are standing 5 feet apart. And that's a, some of those kinds of things can get kind of touchy. I worked one project one time where there was this huge debate on a pipeline, who's going to provide the flange gasket, the 29-cent gasket, and this is, we spent $100 debating. It was pretty frustrating, and I still remember that. On page 2-19, you talk about labor compliance and prevailing wage. I don't think there's any federal money on this job now, but if there is in the future, if there's any possibility of that, you might want to insert a Davis-Bacon wage clause. Just to be sure, it may not be applicable, and that's kind of a recommendation. On page 3-3, paragraph 13, you reserve the right to hold public hearings. It would be worthwhile, I think, to mention this specific body, the governance committee, right there. And after all, that's what we're doing.
Bill, where was that again? 3-3-13?
3-3? On paragraph 13, about number page 3-3.
Yep, okay, good, got that.
Yeah, I would actually mention this committee specifically in there. And okay. Then on page...
If I may interrupt, Bill, and just jump in there. I mean, that may be in conflict with the governance committee agreement, and may need to tweak that a bit, because the process for this committee's review of the proposals is spelled out in detail in that document.
And generally speaking, we stay out of it. We give our recommendations next week, and then we stay out until you make your final decision. And this would be inserting, if we follow Bill's advice, it would be inserting the governance committee midway through the process, which we debated and decided we didn't want to be in the middle of.
So I think we're probably going to hold that 13 would be my recommendation. We can discuss it internally, but I think that may have inadvertently made its way in here. Because again, I think it's inconsistent with the governance committee agreement.
On page 3-4, paragraph 3.5, you talk about addenda to the RFP, and I'm sure there will be some. There needs to be a real clear statement in there that any response to an inquiry goes to all. You may get one inquiry, but the response goes to all proposers, not just the inquirer, and in the form of an agenda or some other communication is appropriate. So everybody's bidding on the same job, is what it amounts to. And those are my PTU's issues for the day. Thank you.
And so an example of an addendum might be when you get together and meet with the DB firms and you talk about something like the magnitude of the letter of credit.
Yeah.
And if they convince you to lower it or increase it, that would be an addendum that you would...
We would issue to all the bidders.
To all the bidders. Yeah.
Okay. The biggest one's going to be the Cal Poly work. Because right now,
right.
That's going to be, you know, there'll be a kind of a somewhat final report in June, but the team's still going to work on it through August. Mm-hmm. So in August, we would want, by an addendum, issue those reference materials for them to get our feel for the content of the architectural stuff. So we know about that one for sure.
And, yeah. And I'll add to it again the example Chairman Burnett identified on the letter of credit. After the meetings with the teams and to the extent we revise the DB agreement, we will issue an addendum with a red line of the DB agreement against the issuance draft just to show all the changes that we decided to make based on input received from the teams.
Okay. Bill, anything else? Don, Charles, or anyone, anything that you want to identify at this point? Okay. We will take this back up next Tuesday and
Water Authority will be working on later on today.
Just a question, since I will be here for Tuesday. Arlene, will the notes be available for Jeannie or by then? Your notes? Your minutes?
I can try to get them done for her, yes, so that she knows what's going on.
Okay.
And also, we have a recording, and I'll do my best to get them prepared for her.
Well, in case she doesn't have enough time to listen to the report, I'll see that I can transcribe my notes and get them off to Jeannie too. I just wanted to have what level of understanding she understands from today. All right, thank you.
I'm also happy to send my notes, although they're cryptic, because they're for my use, not necessarily for her understanding.
Well, at least they're typewritten form.
Penmanship's okay. Okay, we will wrap up that item. Thank you. Oh, so
just one question, Jason. How are you going to handle this for this two meetings coming up this afternoon?
That's one of the reasons I was taking my notes. I'm going to go through the list of issues that we've discussed. I don't know whether Cal-Am is available for those meetings later on today or which members of Cal-Am might be available. The plan, we've distributed Alex's 57 comments to the Water Authority.
She's already done that.
Yeah, she's already done that. Leslie has. And Jim Colm also distributed some comments, which I haven't gone through, but we'll take up at the TAC.
I was just thinking what came up here today verbally.
I have my notes, and if you're at those subsequent meetings, please feel free to.
Oh no, I'm just jump in. But just thinking it would save time if people knew there were all these points that had been raised and discussed.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for opportunity to go through this and for the overview. We'll turn to the status report on the development of a term sheet for a power sales agreement with Monterey Regional Waste Management District for use of landfill gas generated electricity for the proposed desalination plant. And Bill, is this your item?
Yes, I would. First of all, I wanted to thank the committee. The committee's me and Rich Finland, Dave Stoll, William Mary of the Waste Management District, and Keith Israel of MRWPCA. Got together, we had one meeting with a draft term sheet prepared by William Mary and went over it pretty thoroughly about the requirements for our Cal-Am's requirements. At Dave's request, it's now renamed, it's a PSA, Power Supply Agreement. And it's an agreement, actually, between the Waste Management District and Cal-Am. The authority is acting as like a facilitator to help put it together and move things along. After the first meeting, William Mary from the Waste Management District owes us some information on capability and capacity. Rich has offered his material in two phases. Last week we got the material on time phasing, how much power we need and when for a 9.6 in a smaller plant as well, and then I just received yesterday, but then I wasn't working on it because I've been reading this. We have received the power quality requirements from Cal-Am as well, and so William Mary has agreed to redraft the term sheet based upon his own input as well as that from Cal-Am. And then we'll schedule another meeting to go over the details. I mean, some of those things in there are negotiable. So once the term sheet is done, we can then move to a PSA, what I call a more binding document. At this point in time, from my own review, it looks like Cal-Am can, earn the renewable energy credits as well as save some money on buying the power from the landfill. They have the capacity to provide the 5 megawatt demand, maximum demand. It's actually 6.2 megawatts if everything runs all at the same time, which almost never happens because the units are set up to standby, if you will. So they have the capacity to provide all the power. We had originally involved MRWPCA because we were thinking about using digester gas as a source of raw material for the generators. It appears that won't be necessary, but that's still a good fallback position if we decide to go that way later on in the future. So it appears that Cal-Am can get a favorable price. You'll earn some environmental benefits, and the Waste Management District will get some much needed revenue. And they can sell it to Cal-Am for the wholesale price that they're selling it to PG&E for. So at this point in time, I'm estimating the price of about 8.5 cents. So if you use in your RFP 10 cents, which is the number quoted in there today, that's a good conservative number, and that everybody will be proposing on. That's it. Any questions?
Thank you, Bill.
I
have a question, Dave.
I'm going to distribute to the committee some standard terms and conditions from the PPA that I was referring to at the meeting that we had, so that we can begin to take a look at them. Because I don't think Williams' old PG&E contract is 20 years old or 25 years old. I'm not sure it's going to be the best model, but we haven't gotten that yet.
Well, certainly this is going to look good for the community overall. What a great reuse of material.
Can I, not to be pessimistic, but just to be fair warning, and this is something that, we're going to look into further, but it's very tough to start 1,500 horsepower motors, and we need to make sure that's looked at. When he's got 5 megawatts of power being generated by 5 or 6 generators, to start a huge motor like that is a really tough load. And so that's some of the power quality things we sent out just as a starting point. They're not final, but we threw it out there because we got to make sure. And we're going to put the same burden on PG&E because we understand that we're at the end of their lines as well, and so we don't want to create brownouts and flickers when we're starting these large motors as well.
You have a big amp drawer, isn't it, when you start up those motors?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the question.
And it's tougher when you're starting off a generator off as opposed to the grid, because the grid has some other inherent abilities to absorb things, and direct feed may not. So the RFP we have set up, we have if you want to look into it, there's a one-line diagram as a starting point that shows how they could both work together to give us some insurance that wouldn't happen. But we want to make this work, but I don't want everyone going that way down the road, and we'll find out later, we can't even start the biggest motor, so we want to be a little bit cautious there. So we're
running the extension cord.
Well, and we have the same issues, with ASR. PG&E's like, well, please don't start all the pumps at the same time. And it's just when you're on the edge of their system, you can wreak havoc.
Right. Because then we'll get other complaints. Right. Why are they starting out now?
It's not about a peak time.
So Bill mentioned that the power would likely be competitive, and even if Cal-Am receives the RECs. Has there been thought as to what you may want to do with those RECs? Do you retire them and get the credit for being green, or do you sell them and generate money to offset other costs? Some blend of that?
Or do we let the Waste Management District keep them
and get lower
and use that to lower our price?
Right. Because those RECs are.
It might be more advantageous for the Waste Management District to keep the RECs and sell them separately. Yeah. They're quite valuable. Yeah. We actually initiated the discussion of that at our last meeting, and we'll have to see where that goes. But I think PG&E would like to have them, and there's certainly value to them. So it's a, where that has the effect of lowering the rate to Cal-Am or proves advantageous to the district, which would indirectly lower the rate to Cal-Am. Both of those, I think, are good options. But we'll have to see how the discussions go out. But that's a key issue, and thanks for bringing it up, because they are sold separately, the power and the RECs.
But it's my impression that they're worth a
few cents a kilowatt hour.
Yes.
So you could be talking about 8.5 cents, including the RECs, or you split the RECs off and you're talking 5.5 cents. So we really need, and that's a big decision that we need to make, and it's not going to be an easy one. I can well imagine a good portion of our community saying, yeah, absolutely, we want to have a minimize the greenhouse gas footprint associated with this desal facility. I completely respect that point of view. I also imagine a large portion saying this is going to be expensive enough, and we want to lower our water bills, and electricity at 5.5 cents is going to save a lot on water bills, and I completely respect that point of view. But it's a huge policy decision that's going to have to be worked out.
And we may need PG&E to start these big motors, and then we switch over to that power when we're more stable, and so there's going to be somewhere in between.
Right.
So we got to look at all those together, and I'm in the process of getting a firm.
Right, but then that. You're not going to be at the
no.
B20 tariff and. Yeah,
so we're going to study right
yeah.
now.
So this is like a really complicated analysis that needs to be conducted by people that specialize in this stuff.
Just in terms of the treatment of the RECs, whether you monetize them or retire them or leave them with the waste management district and implicitly are monetizing them so you get lower electricity rates because you're leaving them there. Has anyone talked with DRA? Because I can guess where they'll.
Well, I guess from our perspective, Jason, we're going to want the lowest price possible. I think the discussion, you know, I remember when William was here last time, he's looking at this differently. He wants the highest price possible. And so I think it's a market conversation that will have to happen is if what is the price at which he's willing to sell us the power with RECs or without RECs? We don't have any need for the RECs at Calium. So we'd want to monetize that and get a price reduction. I guess the question is, back to the Waste Management District, is, well, what's the best thing for them? And, you know, together, how can we make it a win-win? So I think more discussions need to be had with the Waste Management District to figure out where to go.
But what I'm hearing you say is that from your perspective, the answer is to monetize them. The question is how best to do
yes.
so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if somebody says you can have 5 cent power or 8 cent power, we're going to take the 5 cent power.
Right.
Well, but you've got to make sure you've got reliability. And
yes.
And if it's 5 cent power, but your standby rate is through the roof for
20,
yeah. 18. Yeah, so really, I mean, what Rich has to do is take all of these circumstances, start up the different tariffs we might have to have from PG&E plus whatever we could get from the landfill and figure out what's the best deal.
And what I'm finding is there's companies that do the optimization side really well, and there's companies that do power quality really well, but not so many that do them together. And in this case, I do need them to happen together because I don't want to make recommendations that wouldn't work per se, so it has to be so we're working on finding a firm that can help us bridge that gap. And it may be two firms that have to come together. Do that hard.
Okay. So,
as a waste management board member, I just want to put a little different spin on it. William isn't trying to get the highest rate possible necessarily, but he has a fiduciary responsibility to the company to not, we're not the charitable.
Yes.
But he's very sympathetic to trying to see if there's power that he can share with you all. So I think you need to work out all the angles.
It's probably better said than what I said.
Well, it's a 20-some million dollar investment for the Waste Management District to do this. So.
Yeah.
We're going to get into a debt equivalency issue with this PPA or power sales agreement?
Probably, yeah.
Just wherever. Yes.
Okay. And anything else on this item? At this point, it's just a status update.
This is an update and more to come.
Thank you for for everyone who's been working on this, and it sounds promising with the important caveat, Rich, that you're noting with the power quality and the startup, but invest in a big flywheel.
Yeah, and just when I say power quality, I'm not just trying to insinuate any way that his power has low quality, because it's quite as good if it's in the PG&E grid. We just want to make sure it works for
just
the peak doing
game,
the load
peak
we
game
do.
Average for starting.
Some people say, "Oh, it's his power quality is fine." It's just for our duty.
Okay. Discussion of items to be placed on future agendas. I wasn't here at the last meeting, but
we have no new items from last week's meeting.
Okay. And in terms of the Cal Poly. What's the next step from the committee's governance committee's perspective?
The next step would be participation in the next scheduled meeting.
Which we already have calendared, so we don't need to
rehearse. We don't
have to go over that. Okay. Well, we will adjourn until next Tuesday.
Happy Memorial Day, everybody.
And just so we are all on the same page, I have it as 2 o'clock here. Is that right?
And, Rich will be subbing in for me.
Okay. Yes.
Right. And Jeannie will be subbing in for me.
Yep.
It's my turn. Back to you.
And Arlene, we have confirmation that the county will be represented. Okay. Okay.